Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a GOP healthcare collapse. President Trump goes after transgender military members and his own attorney general. White House office politics get down and dirty. A skinny repeal of Obamacare went down in dramatic late-night defeat. Here was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
This is a disappointment. A disappointment indeed. I regret that our efforts were simply not enough this time.
The president repeatedly bashed Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Maybe it was on his mind when he spoke controversially to the Boy Scouts Jamboree.
As the Scout law says, a Scout is trustworthy. Loyal. We could use some more loyalty, I will tell you that.
And White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci's profane tirade against Chief of Staff Reince Priebus making headlines. NBC's Kristen Welker reported the unreportable.
Scaramucci telling The New Yorker Chief of Staff Reince Priebus is an expletive, paranoid schizophrenic, and attacking Chief Strategist Steve Bannon in such vulgar terms they cannot be repeated on television.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, Josh Gerstein of Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington, Nancy Cordes, Chief Congressional Correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, it's great to have you right here.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you.
Also in Washington, Josh Gerstein. He's White House reporter for Politico, also covers the Justice Department and courts. Josh, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Tom. Good to be back with you again.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Josh.
Nancy, can you describe what happened at the very last night? Mike Pence was there. He was ready to break the tie for Mitch McConnell to take a win again, and that did not go down. What happened?
Oh, my gosh. I've seen a lot of dramatic moments on Capitol Hill over the years, but never anything quite like this. You had the vice president who had come up to Capitol Hill because he thought he was going to be casting a tie-breaking vote. He was working on John McCain for several minutes. You had other Republicans, including his fellow Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, trying to get a word in. At one point, Vice President Pence left the Senate floor. Then Senator McCain followed him. Clearly, the president was on the line. But you can imagine the limited power of persuasion President Trump has over this particular senator, who, after all, he said was not an American hero. He has had so many opportunities to apologize. He never has. And then when John McCain came back onto the floor and showed, flashed that thumbs down, the look of dejection on leader Mitch McConnell's face, the Republican, and elation on the Democrat's face, and then Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader, waving his arm frantically to Democrats, saying, look, don't count your chickens before they're hatched. Don't celebrate just yet. It was truly an extraordinary moment, and it is so unusual on big votes like this that you really are in complete suspense about what is going to happen.
John McCain making a plea last night that people finally sit down together. This is a news conference before debate over the Senate health care bill.
When we passed Obamacare in 2009, it split us. It split us dramatically, and it split us for years. It's time we sat down together and came up with a piece of legislation that addresses this issue.
Josh Gerstein, I mean, this was something to see. John McCain out of his hospital bed and on the Senate floor earlier this week, voting for to proceed with debate here, and took all kinds of heat for that. People saying, oh, great, you got all your health care paid for first class by the American people, and now you're looking to take it away from millions. Then last night, he cast the vote. Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, that's a story too. Susan Collins of Maine, also those three. Josh, is the White House giving up?
I mean, they seem to be. I mean, we may see some sort of death throes or death rattle here. But, you know, they've already given up on this once. It's now they've been taken to the edge once again and then defeated. And so I do think that at this point, rather than continue to seek punishment on this healthcare issue, they will now finally turn to other subjects, maybe tax reform, or if that proves too hard, simply a tax cut, because President Trump desperately needs some kind of legislative win at this point. Aside from the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, there is really zero for him to show on the legislative scoreboard in terms of any achievements. And, you know, beginning to get ready to go into another election year next year would be great for the White House to have at least some legislative accomplishments they can point to.
Nancy, can you imagine Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill ultimately finally being forced to work together as John McCain appealed yesterday?
I can imagine Republicans and Democrats in the Senate working together in good faith to try to come up with a package of fixes for Obamacare. What is harder to discern right now is whether House Republicans, who are by and large more conservative and also extremely frustrated right now because they did manage to pass their own reform bill back in May. Hard to know right now whether they would be willing to accept that coming over from the Senate. Also hard to know whether President Trump would be willing to sign it. I mean, after all, he has already tweeted, good, let's just let Obamacare fail, which is what I've always said. He's always said a lot of things on this issue, of course, that are often contradictory, but that is one of the things that he has said. And so, you know, a big question is, if the Senate can come up with something, is it something that the House and the White House can accept?
Jack, what do you make of this whole drama, ultimately this whole spectacle?
Well, in the first place, this is a failure of the Republican Party. There's no question about it. For what, 7 years, they've been saying repeal and replace. They couldn't do it. Why they couldn't do it partly goes to their nature as a party. They are the only conservative party in the developed world, I think it's fair to say, that is against extending, using the government to extend health insurance to the uninsured. In other words, wherever you see conservative parties, as in Britain, they are for the national health. In Canada, they are for the system they have. The conservative parties are not here. So they simply can't ideologically deal with that question of how to extend health care to the uninsured, to people who aren't covered on their jobs, and the usual way, via tax subsidies. Nope, can't do that. The other way, requiring people to buy insurance. No, that interferes with people's freedom. They're not capable of doing it. And second, I'm just on a personal level, John McCain. I mean, he's a hero, and he's all his life has been in that mold, and he's had his ups and his downs. But it's hard not to just feel that he lived up to his billing last night. And it's not an easy thing to look at his colleagues and say, "I'm sorry, I'm not going to go along with you." Murkowski and Collins too, but for the old sailor, I think it was one of his great moments.
Josh, in the end, I'm reading here people saying, well, this didn't pass in the end because in the end it became strictly a partisan fight. This bill in itself wasn't worthy. I mean, the senators themselves weren't bragging on it. They were saying this is just a way to get it over the line to the House. Then we'll talk about it. That it was a kind of a full of partisanship, but empty of a real health care solution, many are saying.
Right. It was kind of, bastard child legislation. I mean, there was nobody that really liked the bill. You're quite right. It was just a way to keep the process alive, a sort of a bizarre spectacle to see this press conference, which I think even McCain was at earlier yesterday, saying that they would take this option of putting together the skinny repeal, which they didn't like. Now, part of the reason they didn't like it is because the process that we were in the Senate allowed only certain types of legislation, and that was so that they could get this across the finish line in the end with just 51 votes. One of the other problems they'll face as they try to go cooperate perhaps with Democrats, or Democrats try to pick up Republican support for some of the changes that they would like to make to Obamacare, is that a lot of those substantive changes, once you stop talking about just deleting things completely or adding more money to the system, if you're talking about substantive changes to how the system currently works, you need 60 votes if someone's going to object, and somebody is certainly going to object in the Senate. And so that's why even those more minor changes, it's not entirely clear how those go forward. And then the other thing that I wonder about this, you said in the lead-in, Tom, you had a clip of the segment from talking about from NBC News, where they were talking about the chaos at the White House and this very this interview that was given by the Anthony Scaramucci.
Jammed with profanity you can't even repeat.
Exactly, and you had a variety of expletives and very colorful terms for pleasuring oneself that were all said in this on-the-record interview with a reporter. And you just wonder the degree to which the utter chaos surrounding the White House infected this process and some of the crazier things that have gone on. For that impact, I would really look maybe less to McCain than to somebody like Senator Murkowski in Alaska, who was apparently threatened with having punishment inflicted on her state, on losing federal money, on having things taken away from her. There were very blunt threats delivered both to her and her other Senate colleague from Alaska. And by all signs, that was completely counterproductive. And I just wonder if that whole atmosphere led any threats or even persuasion that the White House tried to invoke on this health care debate to not only be unsuccessful, but perhaps to even be counterproductive.
Nancy Curtis, how do you see the White House, the president's sway on Congress and Republicans there at this point, after all the high color, shall we say?
Well, I talked to Lisa Murkowski yesterday and asked her whether she felt like she was threatened by the Interior Secretary. And she said, well, let's just say it was a difficult conversation. But it's a conversation that perhaps the administration didn't think through because, for one thing, she chairs the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, which has jurisdiction over the Interior Department. So he's threatening her, but she can make his life just as miserable. And obviously, it didn't have a lot of impact on her. If anything, it cemented her decision to vote no.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, it's Tom. Before we get back to the show, I wanted to tell you to be sure and stay with us till the very end of this podcast for a preview of Freak Out and Carry On. It's WBUR's new podcast that addresses today's politics through a historical lens. Give it a listen, and thanks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. The Senate GOP health care fail, profane feuding in the White House, Trump tweets for a ban on transgender military members, the Boy Scouts of America apologize for the president, his remarks at their jamboree in West Virginia this week. Josh Gerstein is with us from Politico, covers the White House. Nancy Curtis is here, chief congressional correspondent for CBS News. Jack Beatty is with us, and you can join us as well. What do you make on health care? Will Obamacare implode? The president says, let it. What do you think about the president trashing, humiliating his own attorney general? Is the president right to throw transgender individuals out of the military in a tweet, or try to? Is the military right to say, wait a minute, that's not an order. We'll wait for a proper order here. Lots of callers on all this. Let's go to New Orleans and Carol. Carol, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, John McCain just oozes in character. I mean, this man is outstanding. Here he comes after having a diagnosis of brain cancer. And because of our great healthcare system, they caught his when it was at its earliest stages. He is, he just oozes in character. Right now, the executive level of our government is just we have no viable executive branch of government. Thank God for the Congress and the judiciary right now, because right now our nation is in crisis. But John McCain is one outstanding American, and I'm a Democrat, and I love John McCain. I think Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins are good people, too. But John McCain is out of this world.
Up for John McCain from New Orleans today. One more right here. Rob, thank you, Carol. Rob in Iowa City. You're on, Rob.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
We talk quite a bit about healthcare delivery and health policy, and the way I see it, access to healthcare is a matter of justice. It's not a matter of charity. You know, from an early age, we're taught that in America, justice isn't reserved for people that can afford it. We believe in justice for all. So any future discussion that we have on healthcare has to start from the premise that access to healthcare is a human right.
Rob, did you say you are a medical student yourself?
Yes.
We're losing your line there, but we got that. And healthcare is a matter of justice. We'll see where that goes. Maybe that's where we're headed. A lot of people talking about that, but the Republicans were not going that way this time. And some of them, Nancy, I want to play this for you. It's not just the White House that got pretty hot this week. We had Republican Congressman Blake Fahrenthold in Texas. He was on a local radio show in Corpus Christi last week, and he went after some female Republican senators for opposing the contested Senate health care bill, nearly on the radio threatening violence.
Some of the people that are opposed to this, they're some female senators from the Northeast. If it was a guy from South Texas, I might ask him to step outside and settle this Aaron Burr style.
Well, okay, talk to John McCain, Representative Fahrenthold. But that was kind of incredible, Nancy. You know, females from the Northeast, and let's have a duel? I mean, what the heck?
Right. I mean, you know, he is one of this small group of House Republicans who do say some pretty incredible things from time to time. So then the decision is, do you give that a lot of attention or
yeah.
Do you just sort of ignore it because it does not represent the views of a majority of lawmakers in the House or Senate? But you know, the key problem that your caller was homing in on was that as badly as Republicans wanted to come up with a repeal plan, one of the key reasons for its failure was that they were more focused on coming up with something fast and coming up with something that they could say was not Obamacare than they were with coming up with a cohesive approach to health care that was a legitimate alternative to Obamacare. It showed in the fact that it was very difficult for them to advocate for it or to talk about what would be better about it than Obamacare. They really couldn't point to any analysis that showed that the numbers would be better than it was under Obamacare. They could always talk about why all the analyses were wrong that showed that, you know, more people would be uninsured and all the rest, but they could never point to any other review of their legislation that showed that things would potentially be better. And then in the end, you know, in a really cynical move, they basically brought up this skinny repeal bill. They introduced it 2 hours before they voted on it. That was the first time anyone saw it. And they openly said, this is bad legislation. We know it. It's bad policy, but just vote on it anyway so we can get to a conference with the House. Well, that's not the way you do legislation because there was a very strong possibility, despite everyone's best intentions, mm-hmm. that they might get together and have that negotiation, and that negotiation would fall apart. And then guess what? The House would try to pass skinny repeal, the very legislation that Senate Republican leaders were insisting would never become law.
And this, John McCain's point, I guess, this week. Let's get back to regular order here. Let's get back to proper committee hearings and debates so we can really have responsible legislation. John McCain appealing for that. Regular order, not exactly on display at the White House this week. Pretty wild with Anthony Scaramucci going after, he's, of course, the communications director, the new one, going after Chief of Staff Reince Priebus. Josh Christian, what is this all about? I mean, look, we're not, you know, we were born at night, but not last night. I'm sure there's been colorful language in the White House before, but this is just about as far out there as you can get. And it was spoken to a reporter who went right ahead and reported it. What's going on? What's the source of tension here, Josh?
Well, these tensions really existed all the way back to when the president first came into the White House in January. Scaramucci was up for a job at that time, and in colorful language in that interview you're discussing, talks about how he was blocked. He uses a slightly different variant of that term from that job back in January.
Super vulgar. Super vulgar.
Right. And then the person he blames for that is Reince Priebus. And he's making this, he's blaming Reince Priebus for this at a time when Priebus's fortunes in the White House, at least in the eyes of President Trump, in the, according to many of the sources we've talked to, are at a relatively low ebb. We've seen Sean Spicer say that he was quitting due to this shakeup in the communications department. He, of course, was the very famous press secretary for the White House. And it's seen that the Priebus wing, if you will, of the White House is in some sort of decline. And then we had this whole discussion in this interview of leaks, and the president is incredibly angry about leaks of all kinds, not just leaks of classified information related to the Russia investigation, but also just leaks about these machinations within the White House. We had a communications staffer who was fired just a few days ago by Scaramucci, even though Scaramucci hasn't started his job yet, and talk of more firings. And in that article, Scaramucci basically directly blames Reince Priebus for orchestrating many of these leaks. So it's an incredible internal fight in terms of the language that was used, the very colorful,
obscene, went after Steve Bannon with the most kind of obscene
commentary. I hear from folks that have known Scaramucci for some time that this is the way he used to talk and has talked for years on Wall Street, that it's sort of a bro speak, if you will, among people like Goldman Sachs traders and so forth. And it's vulgar and obscenity laden, but that he would do that with a reporter and not get some explicit agreement from the reporter that was off the record is bizarre conduct for a White House official in the several White Houses that I have covered. I've never seen anything quite like it of that magnitude or intensity. And then to defend himself by saying that basically he thought the comments were off the record is to say that what he was intending to do was basically leak all of that information to a reporter, which just leaves your head spinning.
I mean, whatever you thought was happening, it gives you a sense of just how cranked up things are in the White House. And then Scaramucci talking about himself and Reince Priebus as Cain and Abel, the biblical story of brothers at odds. Here he was yesterday in a phone interview with CNN.
If you want to talk about the chief of staff, we have had odds, we have had differences. When I said we were brothers from the podium, that's because we're rough on each other. Some brothers are like Cain and Abel. Other brothers can fight with each other and get along. I don't know if this is repairable or not. That will be up to the president.
Nancy, I mean, you're watching this from Capitol Hill. How's this being received in Congress? This is a presidency that was supported by a lot of fundamentalist Christian groups. You've got very conservative members of Congress who presumably are not so keen about this kind of comportment. Is this just forgiven, or are people saying, what's going on down there?
You know, more than the vulgarity, I think what concerns Democrats and Republicans alike on Capitol Hill is the fact that what Scaramucci has been saying reveals a White House staff that is, at loggerheads and appears to have knives out for one another. He's only been there at the White House for 5 minutes, and already he appears to be the sworn enemy of two of the other most powerful people at the White House. That means that when he came in, the president already clearly knew that there was incredible animosity between Scaramucci and Priebus and Bannon. It's easier to understand now why Sean Spicer said, if he's coming, I'm going. And the fact that the president, who watches a lot of TV, as we know, and has clearly seen the criticism that his White House appears to be completely going up in flames right now, decided to throw another log on the fire and bring someone in who was going to start a battle with other top officials.
Jack, you've got Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the press secretary, saying, well, this is the president likes competition. This is the way we get the best out of people. Is that what we're looking at, Jack?
Dynamic tension. That used to be Ben Bradley's motto at the Washington Post. You know, I mean, to go back to the original, I appeal to my colleagues to say whether I'm correct or not, but Reince Priebus didn't want this man in the White House because he has a deal pending. He's the mooch, to use his cognomen. The mooch is this principal of SkyBridge, a hedge fund, and it is being purchased by a Chinese firm. And the deal was consummated in January, and it now awaits approval from the Treasury Department, which is subject to influence from the White House. And this deal would land him Mr. Scaramucci, $90 million. He has a conflict of interest with a Chinese firm buying his company, and Priebus in January, I think, didn't want that in the White House.
But there it is. Well, I mean, we do know some of the conversation up on Capitol Hill. There was a hot mic at the end of a subcommittee hearing where Senator Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, was talking with Senator Jack Reed, Democrat from Rhode Island. And this ended up on the mic. They were talking about President Trump's lack of familiarity with how to govern, to put it mildly. You know, Reed said he thought the president was crazy, and Collins said she was worried. It's a little muffled, but you'll hear it.
This is crazy. I mean, I don't say that lightly and as a kind of, you know, a goofy guy. And, you know, the this thing, you know, if we don't get a budget deal, we're going to be paralyzed. DOD is going to be paralyzed. Everybody's going to be paralyzed. And he hasn't said anything.
Hot Mike, they don't know. Reed, I think he's crazy. Collins, I'm worried. Reed, I mean, I don't say that lightly. Again, Nancy, are we just hearing things that we aren't meant to hear? This doesn't matter. This is just throwaway talk. Or is there real worry about this president?
There is real worry, but clearly Republicans, when they speak publicly, are tempered in what they say. And a big part of the reason why is, A, they don't want to be caught in this president's crosshairs. They don't want to be the target of his tweets, but also his base is their base, and that base has by and large not abandoned him. And so they all, for example, rushed to the defense of their former Senate colleague, Jeff Sessions, this week and said what a great guy he is and that he shouldn't be fired and that he has done such a great job. What they did not say was, President Trump, lay off him. This is not appropriate, and you have no cause to fire him. And, you know, at the end of the week, finally, Lindsey Graham, who you can always count on to sort of lay it all out there, said that if the president does, in fact, fire Sessions, it would be the beginning of the end. But almost all of his Republican colleagues basically danced around what's really going on here, which is that President Trump wants Sessions gone because he wants to appoint someone who can get rid of the special counsel, which he may or may not realize would only create an entirely new set of problems for him.
Here's Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican, South Carolina, reacting to that President Trump's very public criticism of Jeff Sessions this week. Again and again, warned the president, don't do it.
If Jeff Sessions is fired, there will be holy hell to pay. Any effort to go after Mueller could be the beginning of the end of the Trump presidency, unless Mueller did something wrong.
Josh, at the end of this week, what's it look like on the AG front? I mean, Sessions has come out and said, I'm hanging in there, but the president went after him hard. Is President Trump standing down? Or people think, well, he was lined up to go after Mueller, but that's history now or not, Josh?
I very much doubt it's history. I mean, the president felt so passionately about this issue. He's been stewing about it for months and months. He really boiled over with anger about this back in March at the time when Attorney General Sessions recused himself from the Russia investigation. And despite outward signs that everything was sort of okay, clearly things were not okay. And then we began to see this outpouring starting at the end of last week and into this week with almost daily tweets taunting the attorney general publicly, which is just, again, a completely extraordinary, I would say basically unprecedented situation to go public with attacks on your own cabinet member, someone whom you can remove at any moment. Now, whether the president is backing away from that, there are some signs. The last couple days towards the end of the week, it appeared that he wasn't making that criticism public anymore. He took a few days off from that campaign, but whether he's abandoned it, I really can't tell you. I know that there is a big effort underway on the part of Sessions' friends in the Senate, his friends in the conservative movement, and his aides at the Justice Department to convince President Trump, mainly through cable television, bizarrely enough, that Sessions is doing a good job and that he should be allowed to carry out some of the policy priorities of the administration, like cracking down on illegal immigration, cracking down on gangs and violent crime, and that they should just let him move forward with those agenda items, even if the president and Sessions are never going to see eye to eye about this recusal and the Russia investigation.
Nancy Curtis, we just got a half a minute before the break here, but when Lindsey Graham says, if he fires Mueller at the beginning of the end of the Trump administration, what does the Republican senator mean?
What he means is that, you know, while Republican senators have given this president a pretty wide berth, if he were to do something like that, which would so clearly stand out to them as overstepping his constitutional authority and perhaps an obstruction of justice, that they would have no choice but to act and to step in.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, San Antonio Police Chief William McManus spoke Sunday about the smuggling tragedy that left 10 undocumented immigrants dead and dozens more injured in the back of a trailer truck.
This is not an isolated incident. This happens quite frequently. Fortunately, we came across this one.
A ride at the state fair in Ohio snapped on Wednesday, killing one teenager and injuring seven.
I heard a girl scream help, and I look over and I seen something fly out. And then I seen it slap to the ground.
And Michael Phelps took on critics who were dissatisfied with his much-hyped televised race against what turned out to be a CGI shark. Here was Phelps.
If somebody actually wants to get in the water and race side by side with a great white, go ahead. You're not going to get the shark to swim in a straight line. And, it would be interesting to see. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah, okay, but what about the hype? We're looking at a week in the news, the Senate GOP healthcare fail, profane feuding in the White House, Trump tweeting for a ban on transgender military members, the Boy Scouts of America putting out an apology for the president's remarks at their jamboree in West Virginia. Nancy Cordes is with us, chief correspondent for CBS News in Congress. Josh Gerstein, White House reporter for Politico, and Jack Beatty is here. Wow, where to go? Nancy, on the Russia sanctions, a vote this week in Congress saying the cranking them up on Russia, Iran, and North Korea in there as well. The president will now have this on his desk. Is it clear whether or not he'll sign? He's not wanting to go that direction.
It is not clear because we've gotten very mixed messages from this White House, including the new communications director, who said in a televised interview after the vote that perhaps the president won't sign the sanctions bill. Perhaps he'll try to impose even tougher sanctions, which we know is sort of the opposite of what the president himself has said, because he wanted more flexibility to remove these sanctions if he felt it necessary. In the end, though, it doesn't matter if the president decides to veto this sanctions legislation or not, because it passed 98-2 in the Senate. I think it was 417-3 in the House, and they need a two-thirds majority to overturn a presidential veto, and clearly they have those numbers.
Let me ask you this. Jared Kushner was talking before the Senate Intelligence Committee this week, and he came out and said this.
Let me be very clear. I did not collude with Russia, nor do I know of anyone else in the campaign who did so.
Sounds very straightforward. Does it look that way to those on Capitol Hill who are investigating this, Nancy?
Well, I think that they were appreciative of the fact that he came with a lot of information about each of his meetings and who was there and who he talked to and why he talked to them. They clearly still have a lot of work to do, sort of doing some fact-checking about whether these meetings and conversations went down the way he says they did. You know, they've got other sources of information as well, so they will sort of, you know, balance what he said off of the information that they've already gathered. And I think that there are still some questions about, even if none of these meetings was all that nefarious, why it was that the Russians, after the U.S. intelligence agencies all determined that they had interfered in the U.S. election, why the Trump team and top officials on it were being so solicitous of them and meeting with Russian officials and dignitaries more than they were meeting with folks from basically any other country, including our allies.
Nancy Curtis, chief congressional correspondent for CBS News. News is breaking in Washington, and I know you've got to go cover it. I appreciate your being with us today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Gerstein, Jack, I want to think for a second about the president's tweet came out yesterday saying that transgender individuals would not be allowed to serve in the U.S. military, this reversing Pentagon policy. And then lots of questions about whether or not this was an order. After all, the guy tweeting, the president, is the commander in chief. Yesterday, in a press conference in Washington, U.S. Army Chief of Staff, this is Mark Milley, said he had not received any guidance as to how to implement President Trump's tweet against transgender people in the military. Here was the Army Chief of Staff.
It should be no surprise to anyone, but the entire force, the entire chain of command will, always has, will today and will tomorrow and always should treat every single soldier, sailor, airman, Marine, Coast Guardsman with dignity and respect for their service and the cloth of our nation.
Now, the Joint Chiefs coming out, Josh, and saying, well, we're not treating this as an order. We're not acting until we get clearer guidance. Where does this stand at this point, Josh?
Well, I mean, it's worth keeping in mind, Tom, that the White House has said publicly that the president's tweets are official statements of the president. So it seems pretty clear where the president's going with this. We've heard that there was a struggle with the lawyers, and you can imagine the president at the moment himself being at wit's end with the advice he's getting from many lawyers on many subjects, and he just decided to go out there and tweet this out. It's somewhat dangerous, I think, you know, when you think about some of the statements that are coming from the Pentagon. The reason they're saying everyone needs to be treated with respect is when you roll something like this out in such a haphazard way, even if you were going to adopt a policy that maybe you don't want to allow any transgender individuals to enlist into the military, if you know that they're transgender at the time that they're coming in, that still doesn't address what you do with people who are in the force, who decide or realize that they're transgender once they're in and how they're being treated. And you could see that some people might see it as a green light to take some kind of, you know, vigilante action or improper treatment of their colleagues. And that's what the military was guarding against. And to me, it's just another reflection of the chaotic decision-making practices in the White House and not following the way these things are typically done with six-month, year-long, year-and-a-half-long studies and rollout periods that are designed to kind of manage these social changes within the military so they're not disruptive. To just have a random Marine sitting in his barracks get this text message or Twitter message at 6 o'clock in the morning and have to decide how he's supposed to treat his colleagues that day is not the best way for this to be handled.
But Jack, this gets us into weird territory, this kind of shoot from the hip. Twitter, is it a command? Is it an order from the commander in chief? You've got the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff now. This is Marine Corps General Joseph Dunford saying in a memo to military leaders after the president said, banned, done. Here's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff saying there will be no modifications to the current policy until the president's direction has been received by the Secretary of Defense and the secretary has issued implementation guidance. In the meantime, we will continue to treat all of our personnel with respect. Now, James Mattis, the secretary, Jack, was on vacation when this came out. And so do you have an order or not? And this is funky territory.
Yes, and it's a resistance from the military. You know, in 1 week, someone pointed out Mr. Trump had the Boy Scouts apologizing for him, the Joint Chiefs embarrassed by his peremptory announcement. You know, it's beyond, well, Hitherto, it would have been beyond belief. But what I'm struck with here is, well, Mr. Trump said it himself in an interview with John Dickerson, I stand behind nothing, he said. And, you know, in the campaign, he stood behind protecting the rights of sexual minorities. That was he held out a flag. He made a big, people applauded the statement in his convention speech. We remember that. And now for political reasons, people think very clearly he had trouble with right-wing conservatives because of the trouble he was giving Sessions. He had to bring them on board. He had to do something to reignite the culture wars. And so this was his political gesture. I mean, it all brings to mind the comment of Lily Tomlin's, no matter how cynical you become, it's never enough to keep up.
But it's not the only hit this week on gay or LGBTQ Americans. We've also got the Justice Department saying that they would not, that they're arguing that they would not see discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation as protected under the Civil Rights Act. On Wednesday, the president announced he would nominate Sam Brownback, governor of Kansas, vocal opponent of gay rights, to be the nation's ambassador at large for international religious freedom. That puts a different American message out there in the world. What about the Attorney General's office when it comes to what will be protected as civil rights and where, what's discrimination and what not? Where's this going, Josh?
Well, you know, the position that the Trump Justice Department took on this issue is not an extraordinary one. I think it's the one that until recent years, most Justice Departments of both Republican and Democratic administrations would have taken, that the civil rights law that covers gender discrimination in the workplace was basically designed to protect women primarily against discrimination in the workplace when it was written in 1964 and every time it's been updated since. And the Justice Department under Attorney General Sessions pointed out in this brief that they filed this week that pretty much every congressional session since the mid-1970s, there has been legislation to fix, amend, change that law, which is known as Title VII, to include protections for gay rights, for protections for sexual orientation. Mm. And that has failed to pass in every single Congress since, I think, around 1974. So it's not a crazy position to suggest that this isn't covered, but it does depart from the Obama administration position asserted through the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission over the last couple of years. And it does seem to go against the grain of the decisions we've been seeing from the courts on issues like gay marriage, which are related to issues of discrimination against gays, lesbians, transgender, and bisexual people. Mm. So it does go against the grain somewhat. I don't think it's entirely out of character, certainly for Jeff Sessions or the administration. But I would say that we might be overlooking the biggest news in this area this week, which might not be any of the things that the administration did. But when the president's tweet on transgender in the military came out, among the voices who opposed that and spoke out against what the president had done were Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah and Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama, two of the most conservative members of the U.S. Senate, people that had long stood on social issues like this in the conservative quarters, said that transgender people need to be treated with respect, and they didn't agree with this message. To me, that was flabbergasting, and in a week where we maybe had less news, we might have marked that as a pretty significant event, but it all got kind of pulled under the waves with just the total level of insanity going on in Washington at the moment.
Catherine in Nashville, Tennessee. Catherine, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to ask if you think that maybe Trump just tweets these things out without consulting with people close to him, considering the transgender ban. If he just tweets it out just to get his base riled up, knowing that nothing will come of it. Obviously, we know Trump doesn't stand by much of what he says. You know, he said he supported LGBTQ. But do you think he just does this to get his base riled up to say, I did something for you?
Well, we'll look at it. I mean, you might say that. I mean, you're covering the White House, Josh. On the other hand, he's commander in chief. Once he says this is done, the ban is on, that's not, it might rile up his base. I don't know, but it's not nothing. It's, he's said it.
Right. And I think in this case, it's more a product of his personal frustration with some of the process and the advice he's getting. And when he's told we can't do this right away, it's going to take a period of months. He's like, why? Why is it going to take a period of months? I'm going to take my phone out of the drawer here and we'll take care of this right now. That may seem rash to many people, but he does believe, I don't know if he thinks that this will rile up his base, but he does think that his candor, his way of being a non-traditional politician, and the fact that he's very blunt on Twitter, that got him through the Republican primary, that eventually got him across the finish line in the November election. And he still seems to think that that kind of a uncensored style is going to serve him well in the White House. I think the turbulence of the last couple months really raises questions about that. But there's no sign yet that he's stepped back from that practice.
The president speaking to the National Jamboree of Boy Scouts this week. President's been invited there since back in the 1930s. But never, apparently, an appearance quite like this one. It ended with the chief executive of the Scouts putting out an apology, saying that character-building experiences have not diminished in recent days. But he said, we know the past few days have been overshadowed by the remarks offered by the President of the United States, who got very political at an appearance not intended to be that. Let's listen to a little bit of the president. Here was before, what was it, 30,000 Boy Scouts.
You know, I go to Washington and I see all these politicians, and I see the swamp, and it's not a good place. In fact, today I said we ought to change it from the word swamp to the word cesspool, or perhaps to the word sewer, but it's not good.
And then he was talking to the Boy Scouts about hot people, hot party in New York, his buddy Steve Ross, who headed up Time Warner.
It was very sad because the hottest people in New York were at this party. It was the party of Steve Ross. Steve Ross, who was one of the great people, he came up and discovered, really founded Time Warner. And he was a great guy. He had a lot of successful people at the party. And I was doing well, so I got invited to the party. I was very young.
And then the President of the United States talking with all these Boy Scouts about a billionaire buddy of his, real estate tycoon William Levitt, about his rise and fall. On other occasions, he's told stories about Levitt, including salacious details about this billionaire's yacht parties. Here he was talking with all the Boy Scouts.
And he went out and bought a big yacht, and he had a very interesting life. I won't go any more than that because you're Boy Scouts, so I'm not going to tell you what he did. Should I tell you?
You want to know about the parties on the yacht? The Boy Scouts chief executive saying, I want to extend my sincere apologies to those in our scouting family who were offended by the political rhetoric that was inserted into the jamboree. This was never our intent. We sincerely regret that politics were inserted into the scouting program. Jack, a little perspective on this presidential appearance?
Well, it throws some light back on that colloquy you had. We ran the sound up between Jack Reed and Susan Collins. Ross Douthat puts it, quote, Trump is clearly impaired. There's something wrong with a man who would say those things. And John McLaughlin, the former CIA director, goes further. He said the cheering evoked the sort of cheering for obvious nonsense that we witnessed in dictatorships around the world.
The apologies out there from the Boy Scouts. Now the rest of us just watch and wonder. Josh Gerstein with Politico covering the White House. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Tom, happy to be here.
Jack, great to have you with us.
Thank you.
And listeners, hey, the On Point National Listening Tour is hitting the road again. Coming up, we'll be in Ames, Iowa, Spokane, Washington. Next Thursday, Portland, Maine. We'll talk with Portlanders about the Trump presidency, our divided U.S. economy, and how gentrification is playing out, winners and losers, in Portland and well beyond across the country. Are you a Portlander or a Mainer? I look forward to seeing you up there. August 3rd, Hannaford Hall, University of Southern Maine. Even if you won't be in the audience, we'd love to hear from you on gentrification. Let us know at our website what you're seeing. And thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Hi, I'm Ron Suskind.
And I'm Heather Cox Richardson.
We're the hosts of Freak Out and Carry On, a new politics and history podcast from WBUR.
Hey, thanks for sticking around for this preview from our show. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe to Freak Out and Carry On wherever you get your podcasts.
Take a listen to this excerpt. Let's welcome our guest, Nick Ameli, director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, author of The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. Welcome, Nico.
It's great to be here.
So, Nico, there's a widely accepted narrative that the media enabled Trump during his rise, during his campaign and his victory. But also, haven't they been enabling him during those first 100 days? Tell me what the evidence shows as to how Trump has been signing up the media as his handmaiden.
So we've done five studies, all of 2015, 2016, and the first 100 days of Trump, looking at media coverage, mainstream major media coverage of Trump, everything from Fox News, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, et cetera. The truth is the media in during the campaign overwhelmingly gave Trump positive coverage. Mm. However, one of the reasons for that is that a lot of the stories were driven by polling. And the story was always that Trump was rising in the polls.
New CNN ORC polls very much about Donald Trump's huge lead as the choice of Republicans for the presidential nomination.
Despite all kind of conventional wisdom to the contrary, he was winning and it won in the primaries. And so that favors Trump in a really overwhelmingly dramatic way.
However, how about the first 100 days?
In the first 100 days, the coverage is overwhelmingly negative. However, most of the time in the first 100 days, the only person that the media quotes on Trump is Trump. I think it's 6% of the time they quote a Democrat, 4% of the time a congressional Republican, almost no policy experts. The stories about Trump, quote Trump. And so it's a very weird dynamic in that sense. It is overwhelmingly negative, but it's also all Trump all the time.
It's a reality show. They're going to the star.
Compared to the last three presidents, he dominates news coverage. So much more of the nightly newscast is about Trump than in the first 100 days than any prior president. It's really astonishing, almost to the exclusion of all other news.
I mean, he's
like, I'm talking about sports news and weather news. Like, he crushes it.
Well, you know, here's the thing. Is somebody mentioned sports news. I'll just mention this. Is that years ago, an ABC producer, I just thought for Ted Koppel, said, why do people watch sports on television? I said, well, I don't know. It's neatly lined. They're winners and losers. No. It's the only thing that occurs on television. It actually happens. Everything else is produced. Trump occurs on television. You can't take your eyes off of him.
In the 2 years of the presidential campaign, it doesn't matter which candidate or which issue. Pick any candidate, and Trump is quoted 2 to 3 times more in an article about that candidate than the candidate themselves.
Good God.
Trump is quoted more on Ted Cruz than Ted Cruz is. Trump is quoted more on Hillary Clinton than Hillary Clinton
is. He had the best lines. Lying Ted, crooked Hillary, low energy Jeb. I mean, you know, you can't not credit a kind of twisted genius in managing that. He hung that around their neck in bully fashion. That's your name now.
I think a crucial question for the media is how they will cover the presidential campaign in 2020. Will they do anything differently?
Well, the problem is if you are either covering Trump or covering the resistance to Trump, he is still defining the narrative.
That's right.